Okay, so thanks to Michael and Isabel. It's nice to be here again. So actually, I was not going to talk about what I claimed I was going to talk about, although it's certainly very closely related. So I'd like to talk about single recurrence properties of measure-preserving systems. So throughout this talk, I'm going to think of X as a complete metric space together with a sigma algebra set and a measure and a transformation. So I want this to be not necessary, but it'll save me from saying anything false at any point. Let me just assume this is an invertible measure-preserving system. Probability system, and by which I simply mean that if you take any element in your sigma algebra and look at its pre-image under this transformation T, then that's again contained in the sigma algebra, and its measure is the same as the measure of the set A that you started with. So one of the sort of earliest results of ergodic theory or dynamics is due to Poincaré. The Poincaré recurrence theorem. So the Poincaré recurrence theorem says that if you start with some set A, which has positive measure, and then you look at the iterates of A under this transformation T, then there will exist some time, if you like, n, such that A will actually intersect some iterate of itself in a set of positive measure, such that the measure of A intersection with T to negative nA is positive. Right? And in fact, the existence of a single n means that there is certainly, in fact, infinitely many. Right, so this is actually a trivial result. It's because we're actually dealing with, I didn't really say it here, but it's because we're dealing with a probability system, then this really is just a consequence of the pigeonhole principle. Right. And in fact, you can say much more about these n's, which are return times, than just as infinitely many. More about that later. Okay, so this result was strengthened by Kinchin. In the following form. So the strengthening in the form that not only does there exist an end to this intersection as positive measure, but there's an end such that the intersection is actually very, very large, optimally large. So what Kinchin showed is that if you take any epsilon positive, then there exists some time n, such that this measure, so then the measure of this intersection is not only positive, but it is within epsilon of the measure of A squared. Right, so, and so I said this is an optimal strengthening because this quantity here cannot be improved if I just considering an arbitrary measure-preserving system. Because if T, it's optimal because if you consider your transformation T to be mixing, right, and then that means that if you look at the measure of A intersection with some iterate of some other set B, then for any set A and B, you look at this intersection, then as time goes on, as n goes to infinity, this will actually converge to the measure of A times the measure of B. Right? So therefore, if we allow ourselves to consider mixing transformations, then the best you could ever hope for here would be mu A squared. So we can't hope for anything larger than that. So an example of a mixing transformation which is not actually invertible would be, for example, considering the doubling map mod 1, would be an example of a mixing transformation.
Bilateral
Sorry? Yeah. Then it's invertible. And so again, of course, there's infinitely many n, but in fact, you can do, as I sort of indicated before, you can say much more. So in fact, it's possible to take this n to being a member of the different set of a set B for any choice of B in the natural numbers, as long as B contains at least 1 over epsilon elements. So for example, you could just take the first 1 over epsilon natural numbers, and then this is really telling you that you only have to go as far in time up to 1 over epsilon before you will find such a good intersection. Right? And in fact, and so this you can actually prove. This is actually very easy to prove. Again, it's sort of customary to, when one proves this theorem, to use the mean ergodic theorem. It's a very nice application, the mean ergodic theorem. But however, this is still, I think, one should still think of this as really being a combinatorial result. You can prove this very easily just using, you could up the ante slightly, you need to use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. But that's it. Just with Cauchy-Schwarz, you can prove this theorem in this stronger form, which you don't get from the mean ergodic theorem. And it's actually also quite nice to, once you've actually established that the n's can take this form, it's then actually a very easy exercise to then show that not only are there infinitely many n's, and not only are you guaranteed to find an n without going too far, but the set of n's is in fact syndetic. So the set of natural numbers such that the measure of A intersection with T such that this is optimally large is syndetic for all epsilon codes. Right. So syndicity is the statement that these collection of n's has uniformly bounded gaps. Right. So some large parameter L such that you look at any interval of L consecutive integers, somewhere in that interval, there will be an N such that this is true. Right? So it's a pretty easy exercise once you've established this statement. Okay, so how could one consider extending this type of result? So one thing you could do is you could look at, instead of just single recurrence, you could look at multiple recurrence. Right, so for example, I guess this is a question, so I'll phrase this as a question. Is it true that for all epsilon positive, well, there definitely, so let's not worry about syndicity and stuff, let's just talk about the existence. Is it true that there exists an N such that you can detect a pattern of the following type? So not just doing a single recurrence, but multiple recurrence. So let's say going up to LN. L be some natural number. So if I'm going to restrict myself to optimal intersections, which is sort of what I'm interested in this case the optimal size will be mu A to the L plus 1. Right, that's one. Right, that's a question. Is that true? And so, slightly surprisingly, and I don't entirely understand why, this actually fails in general. I mean, of course, I've just told you it's true for a single, so it fails in general for L greater than 2. However, you can say something if you impose a little bit more restrictions on which measure-preserving systems you look at. If you assume that they're actually ergodic, then you can get it to be true. So that is true for L equals 2 and 3, in addition to L equals 1, of course. If you assume that T is ergodic, which is a weaker notion than the strong mixing notion. It's saying that it's mixing on average. Yeah, I guess that's true for here. It's not so clear why this fails, and even under the assumption of ergodicity, when L is greater than equal to 4, though. Right. Right, these are the results of Bergelson, Holst, and Kraft. But this sort of subtle business is a result of the requirement that the intersections are optimally large. Right? If you drop the assumption of optimal intersections and just ask for this to be positive, then this is certainly true. And that is of course Furstenberg's multiple recurrence theorem and is equivalent to Zamoretti's theorem. That any subset of positive density, every subset of the integers of positive density contains arbitrary long arithmetic progressions. Okay, so they're equivalent by a correspondence principle due to Furstenberg. Okay, so some subtlety is going on with multiple recurrence. Let me consider then something somewhere between the two. So let's rather than talking about multiple recurrence, let's talk about simultaneous single recurrence. Okay, so this is not a question, this is a true statement now. So now it is true that we can find optimal intersections like this for all. Right, so somehow over here we were considering we're wanting the intersection of all the things to be large, right? Whereas what I'm considering here is I'm wanting this intersection to be large and that intersection to be large simultaneously for the same n, right? Okay, and so this can, and there's no reason why I should insist on it. I could also here just put some c, j, so I could let C1 to CL just be any non-zero integers. Right, so not only can you get the existence of one n, since you've got a large intersection, you can also have that the double of that will also give a large intersection, right, and the triple. Things like this. So this, and just like with this theorem over here, it's again true that you can prove this result entirely using, because in some of this is a nature of the fact that it's sort of linear patterns we're looking for, you can again prove this using purely combinatorial techniques. So again, it's actually true that we can take these n's to be from the different set of any set B you choose, as long as it's large enough. And large enough in this case is actually 2 to the 2 to the 2, where there's L minus 1 of these to the S1 to the negative 1. And this is, as I said, it's combinatorics again, and yet again we're sort of upping the ante. Here you actually need to use Ramsey's theorem. So this is and once you've been given the prod to use Ramsey's theorem, it isn't actually such a hard exercise to do. You're going to combine it with this result here. So this argument, some of what I'm talking about, most of what I'm talking about is joint work with Akos Magyar, and we didn't know that you could prove this combinatorially for a long time, and this was shown to us by John Grismer. Or Grismer. He's a postdoc at UBC. And as far as I know, this actually argument is due to him. about that. Okay, so somehow the types of questions that I'm interested in, if you restrict yourself to these linear patterns, you really can prove it just using combinatorics, although the statements are ergodic. And you get some very precise information about how far you've got to go until you actually find one of these n. And you also get this collection of all n's is a syndetic set. But it's natural to try and, rather than just look at all the n's and the natural numbers, to somehow restrict these iterates in some way, to only consider some subclass of the natural numbers. And a natural restriction to choose is just look for polynomials. So let's now talk about not simultaneous sort of linear recurrence here, but polynomial recurrence. So now instead of, what we really have here is a collection of L linear polynomials with no constant term. So now let me just let P1 up to PL be polynomials of integer coefficients, none of which have a constant term. And let's also get ourselves out of this situation, so let's insist that, or let K denote the maximum degree of these polynomials, and I'll insist that they're greater than or equal to 2. So then there's a theorem, let's call it theorem 1. Which says that we can detect patterns exactly like this, whereas now instead of the linear polynomials we have these polynomials. So it's true that for all epsilon positive there exists an n in natural numbers simultaneously. However, in this case, the proof of this really is ergodic, which means we actually are gaining no information whatsoever. There's no quantitative information about how far one has to look before we find such an n. Right? And that's because this really is an ergodic proof. So I haven't attributed this theorem to anyone, but of course I should point out that within the case of a single polynomial, this is certainly due to Furstenberg. And of course, Furstenberg, if he cared at all, could have proved this theorem as well, right? This really does just follow from sort of known techniques in ergodic theory, essentially following roughly along the lines of Furstenberg's ergodic proof of Roth theorem. And somehow, my feeling is that these simultaneous single polynomial recurrence theorems really are sort of at a sort of equivalent difficulty to Roth theorem, whereas somehow just this, without requiring optimality, I think they're easier. This being said, though, I think it'd be very interesting to know if one could prove this theorem, even just in the case L equals 1, using only combinatorics. Right? Prove something like this. So is there a combinatorial proof? So I'm going to actually sketch it for this, actually. So in the proof, and for example, and also just letting, why not just let it be the simplest polynomial, which you can't handle currently with combinatorics, just n squared. Okay, so now we're slowly getting to what I want to talk about, and that is I already alluded up here that there's a correspondence principle that allows you to deduce from these ergodic statements, combinatorial statements about subsets of the natural numbers of positive density. So that's actually, so this first number of correspondence principle is sort of it's a two-way street when you don't require optimal intersections. But when you require optimal intersections, it's actually only a one-way street. So this theorem is not equivalent to, but it implies the following corollary. So now the setup here, so let me actually say this in a finite setting. So the setup now is that I've got a subset E of the first capital N integers, and I'm fixing an epsilon positive. And then it's true, but if we're in this setup, and N is sufficiently large, so if N is bigger than some parameter depending on epsilon, and all those polynomials that I have up there, if that's the case, then there exists some n such that when you look at your set E and you shift it by a polynomial evaluated at n, then the size of the intersection will be large, and in fact optimally large. So here we have that the size of E intersection with E plus P of n, of course I'm considering L different polynomials here, the density of that intersection is greater than the density of E that you started with, squared minus epsilon. So it's with an epsilon of the density of the original set squared. And again, this is optimal. In this case, you can see that just by considering E to be, for example, a random set. And you could not expect a larger intersection in general than that. Okay. And of course, I'm saying this is simultaneous. I'm saying N works for each of the PJs. Of course, when you're in this setup here, because the only proof I know currently know for theorem one is via ergodic theory and gives no real quantitative information on n, that translates here into the statement that we really have no quantitative information about this. Of course, it also says because we do have some information about n in the case of linear ones, then that translates in a natural way to some nice bounds here in that case. But I'm only interested in the case when k is greater than or equal to 2. However, you could just consider this question independently. Forget that it comes from the theorem 1. And then we do have some quantitative bounds. So let me call it theorem 2. This is due to myself and Akos Magyar. And so what have we been able to prove? We were able to show that if the degree of these PJs is equal to k, just remember I'm assuming it's greater or equal to 2, for all. So in other words, I'm assuming all of the polynomials are of the same degree. If I assume all the polynomials of the same degree, then I can get a quantitative bound on this n epsilon. I can take it to being this monstrosity of being a tower of twos which increases with height as epsilon goes to zero. So it's monstrously bad, but it's something nonetheless. But let me just quickly point out that, and this is using Fourier analytic methods, and using different Fourier analytic methods much earlier, we did show that in the case where L is equal to 1, just a single polynomial, we can actually get something much more sensible. We can take n epsilon p to being just a tower of two twos. And that's actually a result that I talked about here a couple of years ago during the workshop. So I'm being a little bit sloppy here. So this C certainly depends on the polynomials. It would be a little unfortunate. It'd be weird if this depended on the coefficients, because somehow if you go from, for example, n squared to a million n squared, you wouldn't expect the size of the tower to go so dramatically up. It turns out that if you put some gigantic constant at the front, which only depends on the coefficient of the polynomial, then this polynomial can only, this constant here can be allowed to only depend on the number of polynomials and their degrees. Right? So the height can be taken independent of the coefficients, but not the actual bound itself. Okay, so that sort of, this clearly doesn't, this leaves some open questions for sure. I mean, for example, is it possible, maybe I'll write these up. I mean, is it possible to consider, can I use free analysis to tackle this question when the degrees of the polynomials are different? And is it possible to get better bounds than that monstrosity over there? First of all, can Fourier analysis or Komen-Perk handle polys of different degree? And the second question would be, can in any setting when k is greater than or equal to 2 simple exponential bounds, whenever you're considering more than one polynomial, can simple exponential bounds be obtained? When L is greater than 1 and k is greater than 2. Right, so for a while we didn't even know this. As I already said earlier, when k was 1. But then John pointed out this to us. Okay, so in the time that remains, I thought I might try and sketch the proof of theorem 1 and theorem 2 in special cases. And so let's sketch the proof of theorem 1. In the sort of simplest case that we can't handle with Fourier analysis, namely the case of two polynomials where one is n and one is n squared. With p1 being n and p2 being n squared. Okay, so what are we actually looking at here? I'm trying to show that an intersection of this form is large for these two different polynomials simultaneously. So I can rewrite this, of course, as the integral of the characteristic function. Just establish a notation here, really. The integral of characteristic function of A, and then a times characteristic function of A at t to the pn x d mu, which I can now think of as an inner product of 1a with some operator u applied pn times to a, where this depends on t. Right, so what is this operator where this u is the operator from L2 to L2, which sends f to f composed of t, And the important thing here is the fact that T is a measure preserving transformation means that this is actually, this operator U is an isometry on L2. Okay, so it's going to be important to us that U of S on L2 is the same as F. Okay, so the way we tackle proving this theorem is we want to decompose this function, the Cauchy function of A, into the sum of two functions. So I want to decompose this decomposition, I think, was first observed by Krugman and von Neumann. I want to decompose Cauchy function of A into an F plus a G, right, where these have certain properties. So the F, this is not using for analysis. So the F, so what I'm really doing is I'm using Hilbert space techniques. I'm writing this as a, anyway. So the F is, F inherits the properties, some of the properties of this, it remains bounded between 0 and 1. And this is sort of the structured part of the, this is an almost periodic function. Almost periodic in the sense that if you look at its forward orbit, this is actually totally bounded or pre-compact. Right? This can be covered by finitely many epsilon balls. This is clearly saying that F is behaving in quite a structured way under the action of this U. Our G has the nice property that it can be assumed to have mean value 0. And if it didn't, you could just bump its average kind of onto F, and that would still be because any constant function is clearly almost periodic. And this is the G is behaving like a random function. It's weakly mixing. By which we mean that if you look at the average of important, the absolute value of the inner product of U and G with H, then this goes to 0 for any H in L2, right? And in fact, it's also true, it's equivalent, this statement is equivalent to also putting any K here in the natural numbers. And in fact, it's also equivalent to putting, I can put a 1 there or a 2 there or any number there, and it's also, they're equivalent statements. And it's convenient, actually, to have a 2 there sometimes. Okay, so that's the statement that G is behaving like a random function. Let me just make one, actually, let's just make it somewhere else. Okay, so the idea now is I want to, of course, shove this decomposition into there, right? Let's see what happens. So, but first of all, let me just make one observation, and this is coming from the fact that the G has mean value 0. We're, of course, wanting this guy with P of N being N and N squared to be with an epsilon of mu A squared. So let's just note that mu A squared is the integral of the Cauchy function of A squared, because G is measure 0, this is just the integral of F squared. We're in a probability space. So by Cauchy-Schwarz, that's the same thing. It's saying it's less than equal to that. And this is, of course, F in product of itself. Right. So we might want wanting to seek to pull something like that out after I've shoved this in there. Because after all, that's sort of the size that I want this to be. All right, so let's notice what we've got here. I'm looking at that. And I'm looking that. And we know they're equal to this thing here with an n and an n squared. If I shove my decomposition in there and also use this fact, then I can actually see that these are both strictly bigger than mu a squared, and I've got f inner product with f minus u and f, and then I've got stuff with g in it, and then likewise down here I've got the same thing with an n squared and also stuff with g. So it won't surprise you that the next thing I'm going to tell you is that the stuff with g is like error terms, right? So or at least it can be treated as an error term most of the time. So what's the error term statement? I would like it to be the case that all the stuff with g is, for example, is like less than epsilon. Right? So if I look at the collection of the n's in the natural numbers, such that, let's just take a candidate for that, for example. So let's just say, doesn't matter what this polynomial is. So let's just like, so h can just be any LP function, but it's the type of stuff which appears over here. So the number of n's for which this is bad, right, bigger than epsilon, not an error term, has density zero. And the point here is that this, to show this, is really all you got to do is show that this is true, where here you've got the polynomial. Right? So in the case of just n, it's trivial. And in the case where it's n squared, you need to reduce it by reduce the degree by one, and you can do that using van der Korput's trick. So the key ingredient here is van der Korput. There's a slight issue, which I won't go into too much, and that's the fact that you've got absolute values here, whereas van der Korput applies without the absolute values. But that's where the square becomes useful, because then you square out this integral, and you lift it up into the product space, and the absolute values disappear, and then you can apply the van der Korput trick. But it's just a little technical point. Okay, so with that in mind, with that on board, we see that the following estimate, which I could call a main term estimate, will suffice to prove the theorem. So if I can prove the following, I'll be done. So really all I've got to do is show that because these are small on a set of density 1, all I've got to show is that these guys are small simultaneously for a set of positive proportional n. I mean, a positive density. And that's in fact the case. And so this is, one should think of this as being sort of a question of, this is really simultaneous Diophantine approximation that's really going on here. So the statement is that for any epsilon, there exists a C epsilon positive, such that if you look at the number of n going up to capital N, such that if I look at f minus unf in L2 norm being less than epsilon, and I want the same thing to be true with n squared, right, because that will clearly imply that both those terms are simultaneously less than epsilon by Cauchy-Schwarz, that this is true for a C epsilon proportion of integers up to n. So once we have this main term estimate, the theorem will be proven. So let me do I have time to do this? So surprisingly, or not surprisingly, I don't know, it depends what you've seen before, the key trick here is another van der Verden, which is the coloring version of Zemoretti's theorem. So the idea here is that, well, why don't I have a stab at it? So our F, remember, is almost periodic, right? So this forward orbit of F can be covered by finite many epsilon balls, let's say n balls, right? So let's look, so you pick any n in the natural numbers, then UNF must be in one of these epsilon balls, and UN squared must be also be in one of these n balls. They might not be the same one. So this induces an m squared coloring of Z. Right? You take a each one of your n, and you look at UNF, and if that's in the ith ball and UN squared F is in the jth ball, then you give it the color I, J. Right? So what then does van der Verden's theorem tell you? Well, van der Verden's theorem tells you that any coloring, this n squared coloring of Z will contained in that there will be a monochromatic, for example, three-term Hamming progression is all you need in this case. There exists a monochromatic 3AP, let's call it A plus D and A plus 2D, and let's just say the first capital N integers as long as capital N is large enough. In fact, it says more. And by an averaging argument, and this is really important for the conclusion I want to gain, there exists C epsilon times N VAP, each with different set size. Right, and that's where the positive proportion comes in. So that's just a simple averaging argument. Once you've got one, you can in fact get a positive proportion of all those that do have different set sizes. So let me show you that they're really, for each, so let's just say we've got one, let's show that from this D, we can indeed find an N such that these simultaneously both happen, and then we're done. So what does this, the fact that this is monochromatic, tell us? Well, that means that UAS UA plus D F and UA plus 2D F are all in the same ball, because that's what colors. Right, so these are close in L2. And we also know, because of the J, that UA squared F, UA plus D squared F, and UA plus 2D squared F are close. But now, what does this allow us to show? They're not necessarily all close to each other. There's these three close together and these three close together. But then, now we crucially use the fact that a U is an isometry, right? So then this allows us to show, and this is because of the not so amazing fact that A plus D minus A is D allows you to show that UD F minus F is less than, well, let's just say is small, some multiple of epsilon. Now, a more magical fact, namely that a plus 2d squared minus 2 times a plus b squared plus a squared is equal to 2d squared, allows you to deduce from the fact that these guys are all close together that U2D squared S minus F is small. This, again, using the fact that you use an isometry and the triangle inequality. Now, just again, using the fact that you use an isometry and the triangle inequality, you can change this to 2D and change this to 4, and then you just take n equals 2D, and you've got it. Okay, so that's sort of this. I mean, it's very, very similar to the proof of the ergodic proof of Roth theorem, just with this extra little culling argument to get simultaneous. Fantine approximation, it's exactly it, right? I mean, I don't think you can. I mean, it's not particularly wasteful to use van der Waerden at this step, actually. Right. But I'm a little out of time, but I'm going to steal some of your time and give some indication how you prove theorem 2, because I really want to show the analogies between these two arguments. So let me. Let me sketch. The proof of theorem 2, again, in its sort of simplest setup. So the simplest setting here, where we don't know how to beat that monstrous bound, is the case where we've got two polynomials, one is n squared, and the second one is 2n squared. Remember, the polynomials our Fourier analytic argument only works when the degrees are the same. So the setup here is we've got a subset of the first n integers, which I will identify with the group z mod n, and I'm going to use Fourier analysis, as Mariah did in her talk. So let's just recall that if you've got some function like that, then its Fourier transform is defined as a normalized sum like so. Okay, what am I interested in here? I'm interested in this average over here. Just like in the ergodic proof, let me rewrite that average more sort of analytically. So let's, for any polynomial, I can rewrite that density as the sum. It's pretty much a sort of a convolution. It's the characteristic function of e at x and the characteristic function of e at x minus p of n. So as with the ergodic proof I just showed you, I want to utilize the decomposition of this characteristic function and insert it in and get main terms and error terms. Okay, decomposition. So this won't work, but let's see, why not? So we already saw decomposition in Mariah's talk, so I'm going to use the same one. So there we decomposed into an F and a G. And what did this F look like? This F was actually given by an average, actually averaging twice over a Bohr set. And so the Bohr set you should think of as being sort of playing the role of a subgroup of Z mod N. So this F, so we're going to pick some eta being much smaller than epsilon here. So the F is, as with Mariah, it's the average twice of averaging twice just for slight technical reasons, where this B is a Bohr set, depending on this eta, is, remember, it's the set of X's in Z mod N, such that XR, the distance of XR over N to the nearest integer, is less than eta for all R's, which are large Fourier coefficients for E. So for all R such that the Fourier transform of E is large, by which I mean bigger than eta. Right? So then what about the G? So it follows immediately when you let G just be 1E minus F, what it has to be, that this G has all of its Fourier coefficients are small. So here we see that the G is going to be, all of its Fourier coefficients are going to be small. So this property is going to allow us to treat all of the terms, if I push this decomposition into there, all the terms involving a G, I should be able to treat as an error term most of the time. So let me state exactly what you can do. This is the error term. So the statement here is that, here's the thing which is going on here. Somehow scales matter now because we're in a finite setting. So the ends now should live where? So our P ends, remember, are n squared and 2n squared. And our set E is only living from 1 up to N. So the N's that are in play here are just going up from 1 to root N. And that's why I have to keep all the degrees the same. Right? Somehow in the ergodic world, you're always letting N go to infinity. And when N goes to infinity, root N and N, there's no real difference. Right? But for any fixed N, there's a big difference. And so the statement here is then that if you look at any of the terms, so H is just some random thing, any of the things which comes up, and the G looks like that, the set of ends in play for which this is not good is, again, as in the ergodic proof, small. It's less than some power of this eta, and n to the 1/2. So now, to finish off the argument, I'd like to show that when I put the main term, where you just got an F in both these places, that is going to be simultaneously large for more than this many F. Right? So let's make one note before I say that. And that is, if you look at the main term, let's just put a Y in here, then for the same reasons, essentially, as in the ergodic proof, this will be bigger than what we want, at least with an epsilon of that, as long as y is small, because remember, f was defined as the average over some Bohr set, so it's sort of essentially constant on some large scale. As long as you insist that the y is small with respect to that scale, then this is only a small perturbation. So this is going to be true, provided that y is in some different Bohr set where this eta prime is much smaller than, let me lie to you and just say that it has to be at least epsilon times eta. Right? So therefore, we're going to be done if I can show for more than this many n's, n squared and 2n squared is in this Bohr set. Right? So let me just tell you what is true, though. So that what's true, and this really is a simultaneous Diophantine approximation statement, what's true is that the number of n's from 1 up to root n, such that n squared and 2n squared are in B eta prime. And if you sort of write out what this really means, you see it really is a statement of Diophantine approximation. The number of n's for which that true, it is true for a positive proportion. But unfortunately, too small of a positive proportion. So there are a positive proportion of n's for which you get the large term, the main term being simultaneously large, but unfortunately, there are more n's than that for which we can't just forget about the g. So I am over time, but let me be ashamed not to finish. So how does one fix this? One fixes this by refining the decomposition. What we do is we pick a quickly decreasing sequence of eta 1, eta 2, so quickly decreasing. And then for each j, we're perfectly free to decompose this as fj plus gj plus an hj, where this is as before. Right, but with b being b a to j, right? In our previous decomposition, we let this be 1e minus fj, but we just thought that wasn't good enough. But now we let it be 1e minus fj plus 1. Right. So therefore, if I pick these eta's decreasing exponentially fast, the Fourier transform of g is now going to be less than. Well, it's going to be exponentially smaller than that. So therefore, there'll be much fewer bad terms, and so therefore, everything is going to be fine here. We're going to get some n's which will get optimally large intersections and all the error terms, and there's not too many bad error terms. So then we're left with this guy here, which is fj plus 1 minus fj. And we're going to be in business if this L2 norm is less than epsilon. Right? But there's no way to guarantee that. But now the thing is that if this is not true, and this is the reason why we actually have to average twice with the Bohr set, if this is not true, then you can conclude that the L2 norm squared of fj actually increases by epsilon squared at each step. But that can only happen 1 over epsilon squared times. Right. Therefore, for some j, for some eta j, before you get to eta sub epsilon to the negative 2, there really is a decomposition into three functions, such that these first two terms really do work, and this guy has a small L2 norm, which means you can ignore the h. Right, so, sorry I overran slightly, but I wanted to finish.